On March 8th, 1975, the United Nations officially recognized International Women's Day today, which honors the social, economic, cultural, and political achievements of women while calling for action toward gender equality. In our country, the suffragette movement of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, what we now call first wave feminism, was instrumental in passing the 19th Amendment of our Constitution, which gave women the right to vote. There were many other grievances wanting to be addressed, which were listed in the Declaration of Sentiments and Resolutions, primarily penned by Elizabeth Cady Stanton in 1848. The list of grievances included the subjection of women to their husbands and to men in general, taxation without representation, equal opportunity in employment and education and reproductive rights.
The right to vote was the proverbial foot in the door. The following years saw an increase of women in the workforce, and World War II proved that many women could handle the same work as men. By 1961, our country had formed a commission on the status of women led by Eleanor Roosevelt. Its purpose was to examine, report on, and recommend improvements to the legal, social, and economic status of American women. It aimed to eliminate employment discrimination and promote full partnership for women in national life.
This ushered in second wave feminism. It was a decades-long fight. In 1973, Roe v. Wade secured women's reproductive rights. But it wasn't until the late 70s that women gained economic autonomy with the ability to secure a mortgage, a bank account, or a credit card in her own name. The 1980s brought backlash as conservatism grew. The women's movement persevered, and in 1989, the March for Women's Equality and Women's Lives in Washington, D.C., organized by the National Organization for Women, drew 500,000 to protest threats to Roe v. Wade. Helen Reddy sang her 1971 song, I Am Woman, at this protest, and it became the anthem for the cause.
So now we enter the end of the 20th century, in which rose a third wave of feminism. The Anita Hill hearings of 1991 were pivotal in raising public awareness of sexual harassment in the workplace and empowered women to enter politics. In 1992, more women were elected to Congress than ever before, and that year became the Year of the Woman. This third wave also included the intersectionality of race, sexual preference, and gender fluidity that all prior feminist movements dismissed or were prejudiced against. The strength of women, all women, to speak up against injustice was growing. I'll skip the Riot Girl songs of the 90s, but you can search that up on your own. With the dawn of the Me Too movement in 2006, some say a fourth wave began, which has been propelled by the globalization that the internet and social media bring. It builds on third wave's emphasis on inclusivity and asks hard questions about what empowerment, equality, and freedom really mean. Justice for sexual violence has become a major focus that is still bearing out today as we try to shed light on one of the darkest injustices against women and children by men and women in power in our country. Patriarchy has never been just about the men, but it is about the systems that oppress, and women who support these systems are complicit. Elizabeth Stanton's preamble to the Declaration of Sentiments in 1848 reads, "The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her." This may have felt true in her time, but has the whole history of humankind had absolute tyranny over women? Was the world born with a bent toward patriarchy? Written history seems to bear this out as it chronicles wars that conquer, religion that suppresses, and colonization by Western civilization through the ages and throughout the world. The truth, however, is that for hundreds of thousands of years, egalitarian and matrilineal society was the natural state of human social organization. We were nomadic hunter-gatherers with shared resources, collective childcare, flexible gender roles, and no systemic hierarchy. Patriarchy came into play when agrarian societies were formed and focused on property ownership, surplus storage, and settling in one place. The strength of men was revered for not only the physical labor of farming, but for protection of property. Women were then relegated to supporting men and having babies. Land ownership and resource management led to feudalism, which was strictly hierarchical. As these societies grew, laws were written. Hammurabi's Code of Babylon in 2000 BC, Justinian law in Rome in 500 BC, the canonization of the Christian Bible and the Nicene Creed under Constantine in the 3rd century, which from the beginning blamed women for the fall of humanity. Hard to recover from that one. And the Quran in the 6th century, to name just a few, that overwrote the oral traditions of matriarchy and matrilineal communities. Patriarchal empires codified laws that focused on class structure and property rights and denied women's rights, excluding women from owning property, disallowing reproductive rights and legal agency, which forced dependence on men and silenced the wisdom of women who were previously honored for their perspectives. After the Dark Ages, Western civilization, bent on colonization and power, sent explorers to distant lands and obliterated indigenous cultures and enslaved others. Now, centuries later, indigenous cultures around the world are reclaiming their ways. The Stanford Social Innovation and Review, in an article titled "Indigenous Feminism in Our Culture," said, "Patriarchy gives men power and privilege at the expense of women and acts as the framework for the domination and oppression of gay, queer, and transgender people, as well as the stunted development of men." And there's so much to say about that as well. In indigenous communities, as we learned in the video, in the Time for All Ages, patriarchy erases and twists indigenous teachings and worldviews on gender and sexuality, namely the diversity and power of these aspects and experiences. After all, the Diné people of the Navajo traditionally have 4 genders, which we learned about. The roles of Nadle, I'm gonna pronounce these all wrong, but the feminine man, the Dilbai, the masculine woman, have a unique ability and responsibility to act as translators between the Azza, the feminine woman, and the Hastin, the masculine male. And they have a unique ability to bring about balance between the masculine and the feminine. Balance between the masculine and feminine. Hold that thought. But consider this. At the same time that Elizabeth Cady Stanton was writing her Declaration of Sentiments to try to gain rights for women, indigenous North Americans were being stripped of their culture and being forced to sign treaties that assimilated them into capitalistic patriarchy and women supported it. That takes some mental gymnastics. It's complicated, is an understatement. Women are complicit. Balance between the genders within and among us is something I believe we are finally moving towards, and I think we do it really well here at UU. And now I'm where I intended to start, with an indigenous prophecy that came to my attention through Lynn Twist, an author and activist, and was the initial inspiration for this sermon. The Bird of Humanity is a prophecy about this time in history from the Native people of North America. The Bird of Humanity has 2 wings, a masculine wing and a feminine wing. The prophecy says that for centuries, the masculine wing of the Bird of Humanity has been fully extended and the feminine wing has been truncated. In order to keep the bird flying, the masculine wing has become overdeveloped, overmuscular, and violent. The bird is flying in circles as a result of this imbalance. The prophecy says that in the 21st century, the feminine wing of the bird of humanity will gain its strength back, allowing the masculine wing to relax. According to this prophecy, we are in the Sophia century. Sophia, wisdom personified, the feminine expression of God, the divine feminine intelligence that lives within us all. This is not about men versus women, but a balancing of the expression of the positive masculine energies of courage, responsibility, and action, to name just a few, and the feminine qualities of nurturance, intuition, and connection that are present in all of us to different degrees. It's difficult to see even a hint of a possibility in this prophecy a quarter of a way through the 21st century. The archetypal negative expressions of the masculine are in full force, overdeveloped, violent, and destructive in both men and women. I want to believe that the Sophia century is really upon us, and maybe there are hints that it is. Camaraderie of women in the Olympics, the Barbie movie, Taylor Swift, feminine power personified. But when a person is dying, there's sometimes a resurgence of vitality and energy. It can give false hope that maybe they aren't really dying, but are recovering. It can last days or weeks, but usually reverts back to slowly giving up. Breathing becomes labored, and at the very end, there is a rattle in the lungs that is the telltale sign before the spirit is surrendered and the body is drained of life. This is what I hope we're seeing. Not that I want to see it. The rally before death, the last gasps of air in the lungs of patriarchy. These desperate attempts at exerting authority and violence to maintain power structures that oppress and discriminate are horrific to watch. No one who sees it for what it really is has hope it will survive. We, at least in this room, will not grieve its passing. And after the past couple of weeks, it's confusing. A society more oppressive than our own is being attacked and toppled, which we might celebrate. But the methodology is flawed, and the wing of masculinity fully extended is just flying in circles. So how will we know when we're coming into balance? This is not just a white feminist movement for equal rights and equal pay and the right to vote. Women, for the most part, don't want to go head to head with men for power over men. In the book, On Our Best Behavior, subtitled The Seven Deadly Sins and the Price Women Pay to Be Good, Elise Lunan writes in her concluding chapter, "We must walk the inner path of alignment before we can rebalance the world. We must take responsibility for ourselves. We cannot rebalance the world until we reconcile the masculine and its pursuit of truth, order, and direction with the feminine and its tendencies toward creative nurturance and care. Each of these energies is critical in each of us, regardless of our stated gender, in all spheres of life. It's from there we take flight as both wings fully unfurled and the bird of humanity achieves balance between the masculine and the feminine." I didn't say that right. Can I start over? It's from there we take flight. As both wings fully unfurl and the bird of humanity achieves balance between the masculine and the feminine, a third emanating force emerges, a force that allows the bird to stop circling and take off. From wholeness comes freedom.